Good evening and welcome to My Stogie Mystagogy with your hosts, Don Gonzalez and
Mark Connolly.
Tonight is episode 13 of season 2.
That's correct.
And we'll start off with cigar talk. So you had a little trouble with the cigar when you first started it.
I did.
And why don't you start off by describing everything you had to go through before you lit it.
All right. So this is a Monte Cristo number 2 white series. And there's something about it that's a little bit different from most of their white series, as you can tell, because of all the propaganda it was wrapped up in. It has a label that's probably, 2 inches wide?
Yeah.
That wrapped around it. And it's a nice, pretty picture of tobacco plants with a tobacco barn in the back. But it covered up, you know, a third of the cigar. And then it has a regular band up near the end where you smoke. And then at the foot, that's the foot, right?
Yes.
Was another band, which was a white that says Vintage Connecticut. So this is a Connecticut wrapper.
Right.
But it took a while for me to peel the label off, and I was a little concerned about it because I didn't want it to tear the leaf.
Exactly.
And so then, when I went to light it, for whatever reason, it was drawing funny, and I thought I had a hole in it. But it's lit now, and it's working well, and now it's smoking like what I'm used to.
Right. So. Other than the wrapper being in Connecticut, do you know anything about the filler?
That's one of the things we should study before we...
Yes. So I made a point to do that tonight. That's why I was doing a little research.
Yeah.
That shape, I don't know what that shape is called.
I think they call it a torpedo.
Yeah, it's not as torpedo-y as... You know, like some of the cigars that you might see.
Yeah, this almost kind of looks like, if you took the top 2 inches, it kind of looks like an episode of the Coneheads.
All right, I can see that. It's very tapered in the end, it spans out.
Yeah.
All right, and what do you pray? You've got a new drink tonight, too.
Yes, I do. So I went to Specs to go get some more Dewars, and... you know, Specs is a discount place where if you pay with cash or debit, there's a discount. Also, if you get the little key card, they'll label stuff and it'll have, you know, $5 off or whatever. So I was standing there looking at my handle of Dewars that I was going to buy, 1.75 liters, and saw this Glen Moray Speyside Elgin Classic Single Malt Scotch. And with the key card thing, it was the same price. So I thought, okay, I've not seen a single malt scotch at that price, so I'll go ahead and try it. So that's what I bought.
So how is it?
I like it a lot. According to the internet, I'm experiencing caramel, a little bit of fruit.
All right. Well, I can appreciate that.
It actually is sweet. And when I say sweet, I don't mean like Dr. Pepper sweet. But it's not as peaty. Oddly, I thought it would be more peaty than the Dewars is. It's not as peaty. One thing I did read said if you pour it over ice, it kind of brings the peat out, and that is true. But it's very mild. It's not. I'm enjoying it.
Good.
So, yeah, I'm not unhappy with this at all. It's good, and I didn't spend any more than I normally do. And this will last about a month. So,
All right. There
you go. And I will say this, it's interacting well with the smoke from the Monte Cristo.
Well, that's always what we look for in a good pairing of a drink and a cigar.
Yeah, I don't know how to say this since the most I've ever gotten out of a cigar besides the smell of, or the flavor of smoke is pepper. And then with the Candela or Claro or Jade cigars, most usually with the Arturo Fuente 858 is the sort of a grass, a mown grass kind of a sense. But what this does do is they seem to mellow each other out. So if I like take a puff and then sip, or take a sip and then puff. There's a nice interaction there, and it makes it quite enjoyable.
Well, not surprisingly, I'm smoking an Arturo Fuente cigar.
Yeah.
I've returned to the Hemingway series. I don't think I've smoked this particular one on air before. It's a work of art. It's the larger, it's actually the largest of the Figurado shapes. It's a 4.88 by 60. Like the others, it's a Cameroon wrapper, which is unique because that's an African tobacco. And the filler and binders are proprietary Dominican leaf, whatever that means. And this is like the extra large brother to the short story, which is my favorite cigar. I like this cigar because the flavor profile is very similar to the short story. I think it's probably a little bit more, like you said before, the bigger the cigar, the more complexity you can get in the cigar. So I think there's a little bit more complexity in the cigar in terms of the different flavors that I pick up. And it lasts longer.
Yes.
So, like, when I bring a short story over, I always feel like I'm going to have two cigars, or I'm going to be done halfway through the podcast. I feel like I need to light another one.
Yeah.
So, this lasts a little bit longer. You can see, I've been smoking it for, you know, I don't know, almost half an hour now? 20 minutes?
Yeah, at least 20 minutes.
And I've got a good 1-inch ash that's held up. And, so right off the bat, I pick up the sweetness that the Cameroon wrapper brings to the cigar. It's one of the things I really like about it. It also leaves a great aftertaste when you're done with the cigar. You don't get left with that kind of smoky
ashtray mouth.
Yes. It's a little bit more of a sweetness. And a little bit of a creaminess. This tends to be a mild to medium cigar, but a lot of flavors in it. So it's a, you know, it's... Bold doesn't always mean strong.
Yeah.
So I would say that it's got some bold hints to it, especially as you get closer to the end of it. It's been my experience. We'll see if that plays out with this as well. I've also returned to my favorite drink to pair with this cigar, and that's the Pirate Rum. Pirate Rum is not... I learned doing a little research before the show that it's Patron owns... The label, but they don't distill it.
Really?
They actually don't distill any of their spirits. They actually are kind of a third party that goes out and they find all these great flavors, and then they're pretty much master marketers, I guess.
So they just put their name on it, like Trump puts his name on everything?
I wouldn't go that far. But it is a blended rum. I think it's got 15 different blends of rum that's aged in... casks, and the reason I like it is because it has its flavor profile is also a little bit on the sweet side. Some people online say it's got a little bit of a bite when you drink it, the afterburn. I don't feel that when I drink it. I feel like it's a very smooth rum, and it's got the traditional spiciness that you get out of rum, but in addition to that, it's got kind of this blend of orangey apricot kind of flavor.
Oh, wow.
That I really like the way it pairs up with most cigars, but in particular this cigar, or the Hemingway series in general.
Nice.
So I had a tidbit to share about the Fuente Cigar Company. I learned today when I went to pick up the stick at the cigar shop. I had kind of heard rumblings about this on the internet, but I didn't really read anything about it. Apparently, they had a huge shipment stolen from... the docks in Miami, and they haven't really revealed, this was about a month ago, they didn't reveal what it was that was stolen, but it's going to be interesting to see how that impacts their distribution
going
down the road. I went in looking to see if they had any añejos, which is what I smoked last week, and they didn't have any. They also didn't have any of the Opus X, which traditionally Arturo Fuente puts out right before Father's Day. They didn't have any of those.
Huh.
And this place is probably the largest Arturo Fuente retailer in the area that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I think so. They've got more there than, well, I think I said they have more Arturo Fuentes there than the Arturo Fuentes cigar store in Las Vegas does. I think they actually have a wider variety, because I think pretty much in that, what do they call it, Casa Fuente?
Casa Fuente.
They mostly just had some high-end stuff in there. So,
Well, if that's your argument, then I can see that.
Yeah.
I was really surprised today that I saw that they had some Lost City, which is a very rare cigar. A lot of times you can't even find that. You have to attend like a charitable event to even get your hands on any of those. And they also had the Forbidden X, which is another one of their very rare cigars. And they had a good number of the Prometheus / God of Fire cigars that you and I have spoke together before.
Yeah, I enjoyed the God of Fire. I thought it was really good. You had made a comment about the boldness versus the strength, and it made me think of maybe a music analogy or more a speaker analogy, where sometimes you've got a speaker that's not really good, and to hear anything, you've got to turn the volume up. But if you turn the volume up too high, you get some distortion. But if you got a speaker that's got, you know, some oomph to it, you can hear all the music at a lower volume. So I don't know if that relates to what you were saying about the boldness of your cigar without it being just like something that punches you in the throat.
Well, you are the king of analogies, so it's fair to say that.
All right. So the first Monte Cristo I ever had, I think I shared once before, was actually a Cuban Monte Cristo, and it was when I got married. And one thing my dad had told me is that they start out pretty strong. They let you know that they're there. And if you can get through the first, you know, if you're not somebody that likes a really strong cigar, if you'll just wait, it's worth the wait because it really mellows.
Well, the other tidbit that I came with today is that I read my Cigar Aficionado magazine this week. I just got it the other day. Don't you get that as well?
Yes.
And they had a article about gin that I found fascinating.
Really?
I never thought about drinking gin with cigars.
No, I haven't either. In fact, that just doesn't seem...
No, it makes me want to try it now.
Yeah. They have a particular gin they recommended?
Well, they have a list of 10. Some I've never heard of. Some that you've heard before. You know, Beefeater, Bombay Sapphire, Tanqueray. But then the interesting thing that they talked about is how there's this trend of developing pure form of tonic water.
Oh, really?
Like the old school tonic had a... I don't remember there's something in tonic that's citrusy. I can't remember the name of it.
I don't know, but are you talking about like what they used to call quinine water?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And so some companies have played around with that to bring in different flavors. And they actually, in the article, described gin as kind of the original flavored vodka.
Really?
So it makes me want to do a little bit more research about how gin is developed. I never thought about gin that way.
Yeah.
And when I was in college, that's pretty much all I drank. I was a gin. And I've always associated gin as kind of a young man's drink.
Hmm.
You know that. You know, you don't become a man until you start drinking scotch. You've been a real man for a while, I guess.
Well, I've never really drank gin much, except in gin martinis. And I don't like vodka martinis. And Rosie and I got to where we were buying Bombay Sapphire gin at Christmas when they were selling it with martini glasses. And so we have a kind of a collection of the Bombay martini glasses.
Okay.
And so in the process of learning about martinis and all that, I found out that there's a huge variety of opinions on vermouth that goes in there. The original martini recipe was 3 parts gin, 1 part vermouth. And then I heard, I think it was Winston Churchill said, you pour your gin in a glass, and then you show it a bottle of vermouth, and then you nod to France, and then you drink your gin. And then I've also heard of you, they'll pour a little bit of vermouth in the glass and swirl it around and throw it out. So I thought, well, I want to try this original recipe. So there's sweet vermouth and dry vermouth. And right now, at this moment, I can't remember which one I preferred, but I want to say it's the dry vermouth. But with olives and dirty.
Right.
So I like the 3-to-1 mix. I think some people think it tastes like turpentine. Steve tells me it tastes like Christmas trees because of the juniper berries in it, I guess. So, but I like martinis, and then I'd never really had a gin and tonic until last year sometime. I had one at somebody's house.
Now help me out. What has the juniper in it? The gin or the vermouth?
The gin, yeah. It's, you know, it's some sort of herbal magic liqueur, I don't know. You could probably make an argument that it's healthy for you somehow.
Well, apparently it's easy to make.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the reason why there's this increase in variety of gins, because while the distillers are waiting to age their bourbon or whatever, they can go make some gin in a shorter amount of time and pump it out and start making money off of that.
Wow.
But what you described about the recipe, that's one of the cool things about the article. You should go read it. They have at least 5 different recipes on how to make martinis and other gin-related drinks. So,
neat.
What I remember is there's a restaurant on Greenville Avenue that, when I was in college, was my go-to restaurant. It was an Italian restaurant called Torelli's. It's still open. I would take first dates there.
Really?
And they always had a live band, and their food was phenomenal. But in addition to that, they had some of the best martinis in town. Mm. And what they would do is they would take this chunk of ice, place it over the glass, and pour the gin over the ice.
Okay.
Into the glass.
Yeah. Huh.
And so that was my early introduction to martinis.
Okay.
And I heard a variation of the Churchill story, and that was that you open a bottle of vermouth, let the gin kind of smell the vermouth, and put the cork back in.
And then there's the whole shaken versus stirred and all that. And I think stirred has been the way it was always made until James Bond said shaken, not stirred. And I think that everybody went, oh, well, if Bond drinks it that way.
So, yeah, the article talks about that as well.
Does it?
So it's just an interesting article about gin that I did not expect to find in a cigar magazine. Because normally you read about scotch and bourbons and occasionally rum. But
I've never thought about trying to pair the gin with a cigar. So
they don't come out and say that you can.
Yeah.
But I thought it was an interesting spirit for them to profile. And of course, I guess Cigar Aficionado, they already do they have a wine. Same company that publishes Cigar Aficionado.
Yeah, Wine Spectator, I think.
And they've got a whiskey one now, too.
Huh.
Anyway. A lot of ads for the Big Smoke.
Oh, yeah?
Going to be at the Mirage this year on our birthday weekend.
I wonder if I could swing that somehow. We have one of those M cards. Because when we're at Bellagio, it's apparently one of those properties, Mirage and Bellagio, a few others that are all part of the same corporation.
Stacy and I have talked about it. It would be a lot of fun going with y'all.
Yeah, it would.
And they have a one-night package, and they have a weekend package. Stacy, for my birthday several years ago, got me the full package, and that was a pretty good experience. You get to go to all these little seminars, brandy tastings, food tastings.
When you went, was that at the Caesar's Palace?
It was at the Venetian.
The Venetian, okay.
It was the first time and I think the last time they did it at the Venetian because they were ill-prepared. Mm. They had us in the first session we went to was in a big hall.
Yeah.
And they had all the doors closed. And everybody smoking cigars. You had this panel of some of the big names in cigar, you know.
Yeah.
And there's no ventilation. And so you walked in and to me it reminded me of when I was in the Army and I had to go through the gas chamber because the smoke was so thick. I didn't think I was going to be able to handle breathing in there.
Yeah.
It was just so thick. And they finally had to open up all the doors to the hall, and then you could smell the smoke.
Everywhere.
Yeah. So I don't think it was the last time they had it there.
Huh.
I think it's become difficult for them. They used to do them all over the country. Mm-hmm. But now, I think they do one in New York. It's a one-day event. Yeah. And they do one in Miami.
See, they did one here that was a one-day event in Dallas a couple of years. But that's been at least 10 years ago, maybe more.
The only place they'd be able to do it is in Addison. Because mm-hmm. everywhere else has smoking ordinances.
Yeah. I think it was in Addison when we went. Yeah. So.
That's something to think about. Any final thoughts about that cigar you're smoking in? How's it holding up?
It's holding up really well. You know, I think I mentioned before that my all-time favorite cigar is that Cuban Monte Cristo No. 2. Bought some in Mexico that I feel like are real. You know, you never know. I mean, I don't know how you know any of them are real sometimes, but there's apparently a website out there where you can look up serial numbers on the boxes. So if you're in Mexico and you see all these little packagings of Cuban Monte Cristo or Cuban cigars, 3 or 5 and all that, apparently that's Monte Cristo doesn't sell them like that. So those are people taking cigars and repackaging them, and whether or not they're what they purport to be, I don't know. So I looked around at several and then finally found a place that was actually set up kind of like a regular cigar store here, only it was about the size of this room. And it had a humidor, a walk-in humidor, and then they had a humidor case. And they had a box, and I bought cigars out of that box, and they looked right. And I smoked 3 of them. Or I smoked 2. Somebody else smoked 1, and then I've got 2 left that I still have to share with my brother Eric. But still my favorite cigar, partly probably because of the experience. I think I mentioned Rosie's Cuban, and so there were a bunch of Cuban people at this wedding and at our reception. I handed out about half the box to these old Cuban guys just because the look on their face was priceless. So that whole experience, getting married, then we went on a cruise. I mean, the whole thing, it was just really, there's a lot wrapped up in that cigar for me. So.
Good pun.
Yeah. So, I guess that's cigar talk?
I think so.
All right. Anything else we want to say before we get into part 2?
Thought we weren't going to do a part 2 tonight.
We're not. That was a lead-in to when I spliced it into the other one. So nobody can tell. So at the end of last week's podcast, we were talking about fatherhood, and we were having some conversation about whatever it takes. So we're going to recap that a little bit and then continue from there. Here we go.
So Mark, what's your take on that from somebody who's been a father for a much longer amount of time?
So what I was thinking about while he was saying that was, you know, at some level, it's not about you, right? And it hit me that Jesus essentially said, it's not about me, because he was doing his Father's will. So he was here on a mission, if you will, which was to redeem mankind, whatever it took, because that's what you do for your children. And so it just struck me that even Jesus was saying, it's not about me. But he kept saying, it's the, you know, I'm here to do my Father's will. And so we're invited into this continuing of creation, okay? We are allowed to participate in a very unique way in God's creative impetus. And as God cares for us, we are supposed to care for our children. And that means whatever it takes. And so if that means you've got a crappy job and you don't like the people you work with, but that's what it takes to take care of your family, then that's what you do. It's very much not a me-focused endeavor. It's very much an other-focused. So, you know, that idea of surrendering yourself to your duty as a father is not popular, I don't think, but it is real. And it's the only thing that allows a society to be viable. So, I applaud your advice.
Well, while you're saying that, you made me think of Ephesians 5. You know, we always, you know, people always kind of stop at the, it's perceived as this non-politically correct statement by St. Paul that women are to be obedient to their husbands. But the very next line is, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And right. What you just described is exactly that. The you know, in a way, I think that's implicit in that is wives and children, you know, that you sacrifice for them as Christ sacrificed
right.
for the church, and you die to yourself
yeah.
in every way possible.
Yep.
I will say it's having Christ in our life and in our hearts and knowing His love and loving Him back and truly desiring to strengthen that love in both thought and in action makes parenting so much easier.
Because your focus is right. And it's when you accept your role and you don't fight it, then it becomes easy. Doesn't mean it's always fun. But it's actually easy. Because at a certain level, we want to know what we're supposed to do. You know, I mean, how many people say, God, just tell me what I'm supposed to do? Because at a certain level, we want to know.
Right.
And then when you know, you go, okay, now I have a job to do. And now I'm going to do it. And that removes a whole lot of energy sapping confusion and allows you to focus on your job.
You know, Kate and I both, I started praying for blessings upon single parents because successful single parents, they have mad skill beyond my wildest dreams because there's demands, the simple, necessary demands that children have, especially at my daughter's age. I don't know how they do it. And I know single parents that they work full time and they still go to school.
Yeah.
And their kids are being properly taken care of. And it's amazing because it truly is just awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
Truly it is. Because Kate and I, we are a nice balance because we are opposites in a lot of ways. And I've told, she knows this too, so I can say this freely. She has no patience. None. And I guess I don't, some people know that know me know, in the, when I'm driving, I have zero patience. I don't deal with goobers on the road. And sometimes I am that goober and I lose patience with myself. But for whatever reason, with my daughter, very rarely do I get impatient. And then when I do get impatient, it's generally not with her, it's generally because Kate knows I'm doing something that I need to be able to focus on. And here's my daughter in my face. And I'm like, well, why aren't you helping me here? Like, you know I need to get this done. But we balance each other out because when Kate, you know, you have to be able to turn to each other. I know there's a lot of times early on that Kate and I were playing tag team with Gabriella, especially when I was still working security. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd get home and early enough some nights and Gabrielle was putting up a fight, going to sleep, and Kate would just, she was tired, and she was stressed, and so she would just, I can't do this, it's your turn, and I was like, okay, and we had the conversation about, don't let yourself get there, there's no reason for you to get to that breaking point, you can tag me anytime, you know, and one of the things I've been telling Kate is, we have routines. Children love routines at this age. They love having those routines. So we have a lot of habits and a lot of routines with Gabriella. And Kate's bedtime routine is not the same as mine. And although Kate hates mine, mine is successful. When it's just Gabriella and me. And now we've got one together. So if we're both home, the routine changes a little bit. But I told Kate, you know, I'd tell her, I said, I don't mind taking care of our daughter at night. I don't volunteer because you have the routine. This is y'all's routine together. But I won't hesitate to tag in. I'm not sitting here on the couch under my computer watching TV because I don't want to be with our daughter. I'll rile her up. unintentionally. Because I love her so much, and I love having a lot of time with her, so I'm going to get in here, and she's going to be like, da-da, music, and fine, where's my phone? What do you want? You know, and then you're going to get frustrated at me, because you're trying to get her to bed, but you don't, and it's just a matter of, I need you to understand that this is our routine, you know? Let me do my thing with her, you do your thing with her, but if you're tagging me in, I'm not going to go in and do like you do. I can't.
Right.
I've tried it. My daughter sits there and screams at me. It's like she knows. Like, this isn't our thing, Dad. What are you doing? Quit it. Where's my music? Lay down. Pray. This is what we do. And it's just a balance. And it's just been awesome. Because my wife didn't, I don't know if she ever wanted kids. Like, truthfully, I don't know if it was ever even a thought in her brain.
Well, if I may interject, when y'all first got married, I had to pray really hard because my sense was that Kate, when we'd have, you know how your mom was like, when you gonna give me a grandbaby? And Kate seemed very put off by that to the point where it was like, never. And so I was like, yeah, did you really take it seriously when you met with Father that you were gonna, you know, raise and be open to life and all that? And, you know, I said it to a Catholic, I've seen the growth in Kate. We talk about her being Methodist, but, you know, I've seen how much she respects the Catholic faith and how she respects the fact that Gabriella is Catholic. You know, I shared it to a Catholic that, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago at her church, they were having their quarterly communion or whatever, and somebody tried to give communion to Gabby, and Kate said, no, she's Catholic. That's growth, you know? And so she prays all the prayers with Gabby at Mass. So.
Well, part of that was, that actually stemmed before, that respect of the church stemmed before Gabrielle was around, because we do 3 hours with God every Sunday. So we go to service at her church in the morning, and then we go to Mass. So it's generally between the two about 3 hours that we're spending with the Lord every Sunday. And early on in our marriage, I really wasn't participating in her service. And I didn't think anything of it. You know, I'd pray. When they pray, I was praying. But I wasn't getting involved in the hymns. And they do, they have what they call a call to worship that they do at the beginning of service. And some of the phrasing just seemed like overkill. Just, you know, just throwing out, like, just the phrasing. And even today, sometimes it's wonderful, it's spiritual, it's their thing, but even still, sometimes it makes me laugh a little bit. Like, it's a little too wordsy right there. You know, you can step back a little bit. It's cool. But it was actually bothering Kate. And so, it eventually, we had the conversation, look, she actually initiated, she's like, I fully support you being Catholic. You know, that's your faith, but I need you to fully support me being Methodist.
We interrupt the podcast for a visit from the Great Pyrenees, Yeti and Ghost.
Whoa. Two big dogs. Who would think they're little? All right. All 11. Oh, y'all are all wet.
Yeah.
This one's especially wet.
Yeah. He likes to be wet. He's Rosie, and Yeti is me.
So, we had the conversation, you know, about participating with one another. You know, so that when I went to service, I was fully engaged in the service. It's not like anything that they say in service. Nothing they do in service contradicts anything that we have, any of our beliefs in the Catholic Church. For the most part.
Well, it's, you know, part of that is, I don't want to get too far off track, but it's that they like the structure of liturgy, and I think that with most Protestant churches, since they don't have liturgy, they strive to fill in the gaps the only way they know how, and so that's what happens.
So, yeah, and so we just reciprocated one another. She became fully engaged in the Mass. And my conversation with her was this. I said, all my expectations were when we cross ourselves, please cross yourself. When we stand, you stand. When we kneel, you kneel. If you go off on La La Land outside of that,
when I dip, you dip, we dip. Sorry.
Oh, Lordy. So yeah, we had that conversation, and yeah, I know with Gabriella, she did. She took Gabriella being Catholic to heart. And we actually had conversations because there was times early on, like I said, I had to grow in my faith, and there were times early on that I would miss Mass, and I remember Kate has taken Gabriella to Mass on several occasions without me. Like, she flat out, like, almost cussed me out. She's like, you want to miss Mass? That's on you. That's between you and him. But I promised to raise our daughter Catholic, and she will not miss Mass. And
that's impressive.
She has flat out left me at the house. Now, obviously, I don't let that go once that I can recall. Because afterwards, I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. My Methodist wife is with my daughter at Mass, and here I am sitting at home. Oh, heck no. But she's serious. Like, it won't fly. And now there's been a couple times where I've missed, and I've made stupid excuses. Like, well, she, it's not going to hurt her. And that's not true, ultimately. And so it's forced my hand. And, I think I talked about Saturday at Joe Catholic about, I thought I was making Gabriella the head of the spiritual household because she was the reason I was becoming engaged in my faith more. And then, when I was looking through catechism and trying to help myself better understand what our faith teaches us about that, it flat out said that children encourage and help strengthen their parents' holiness. And that's when I realized, oh, you're not my crutch. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're just encouraging me to ask God and the Holy Spirit to help me, so that in turn it becomes a circle.
I don't know if y'all have seen this, but I've seen it with at least two couples that I know where they didn't go to church at all until they had kids. And then all of a sudden they felt like they needed to go to church.
Well, if I can share a little bit about that, you entered my life when you were about 9. And, for years, people would ask me, well, I've shared my story before that, like many cradle Catholics, when I went to college, I strayed away from the church. If you asked me if I was Catholic, I'd say I was Catholic, but I wasn't going to Mass. And wandered around in the desert for almost
40 years.
Well, not quite 40 years, but it was pretty close to 20.
Yeah.
Or whatever the number was. And it was at a small faith group version of Y Catholic, where we were sitting with other couples when somebody asked me, and I had this moment of clarity, and I said, it was Kevin. Because Kevin came into my life. Kevin started asking questions, and I could tell that this little boy's looking to me for moral truth,
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is my moral code? What am I teaching this kid? And, I can't tell you the exact day and how long it was after he moved in with us. But it wasn't too long after that that I said, hey, I gotta start going to Mass. And for almost a year, I just went by myself. I didn't ask Stacy to go or Kevin to go, but started to know the Holy Spirit touched me and said, for him, you got to get your act together. So it doesn't just happen when you become a father the natural way. It affected me as well when you entered my life at an older age. So.
I've always told people that I've actually gotten into fights because, as it's become evident, Mr. Don here is not my biological father. I don't have a clue who my biological father is, nor does it matter because I have spent time with men in my life that have come and gone without getting into details. And I grew up realizing that any man can make a baby. It takes a real man to be a father. And a dad came into my life. Even before he returned to the church, it was evident that I'd found that it existed, and calling him dad was the easiest thing. And then it got to the point where, as far as the world was concerned, besides the millions of listeners that we have, right. He is my biological father. And I remember that if anybody questioned it and tried to dig deep, it riled me up. Because regardless of the truth of the matter, it didn't matter to me. It didn't. And when we talked about it, we talked about Joe Catholic as well, talking about, you know, we had our trials because I was an immature punk who thought, I'm a man at a ripe age of 17, barely out of high school. And for better or for worse, there were battles for the next 5 years. But in between the moments of frustration with one another, there were moments of pure joy, pure amazement, for whatever reason. And one of the memories that hits me hard that I will never forget is when Homer died, our miniature dachshund that we had for 13 years. I think it was 13, 13 and a half, something like that.
Miniature dachshund? Is that like a redundant term?
No, they're extra small. Dachshunds come in mini, and then there's kind of a tweener size, and then standard. A
tweener wiener?
The mini weighs less than 10 pounds.
My miniature dachshund weighs 7.5 to 8 pounds.
Yeah, on really average. Little. And then you have a middle, which is more like Calvin, that weighs about 15. And then my dachshund, Hobbs, weighs over 20 pounds. Pushing 30, really. It's like 24 pounds. And that's the real, you know, dachshund means badger hound.
Yeah.
And so he's the hunter. And he's a real hound dog.
Sorry.
When Homer had an enlarged heart and had other health issues, and I remember, I think it was the day, no, it was either the day or the week of, that he passed away, he suffered from seizures, and he had a really bad one, and so I needed to get him to the vet. And I remember that as I was trying to get him to the vet, I'm locking the front door, and he momentarily died in my arms. I don't know if he choked himself out or what he did, but he went limp and he was gone. And I remember how, like, it was the craziest, and then boom, he was back. And I was like, okay, let's not do that again. But the day he died, I was working, I think I worked the early shifts. I was working at Home Depot at the time, which meant I worked from about 6 to 3 or whatever. And I remember I got off work and I needed to run to Discount Tire, and Dad called me and he was like, hey, just so you know, when you get home, don't freak out. Homer had an episode. We need to get him to the vet. So that's where he's at. So when you get home, you don't see him. You know, that's what's going on. So I was like, okay, cool. Thanks, Dad. Thanks for the heads up. Hope he's doing okay. Took care of my business. Got home. Went to my room. Was hanging out. And then I don't remember how long. Probably an hour or so. Dad knocks on my door. And he's like, hey, I need to talk to you for a minute. My first thought was, gosh, dang it. What did I do now? Or not do, as the case was more often than not. And then Dad sat down the bed, and that's when I knew, oh, something's not right. Homer never crossed my mind. I'm thinking, okay, somebody's died that I know. Heck, it could have been a celebrity. You know, again, I have a theater background, so I have a, you know, I've grown attached to some of the celebrities over the year, you know, distance-wise, just because their art is such a part of my life. So I'm thinking, all right. Because we kind of had a moment like that when Jack Lemmon passed away and then when Walter Matthau passed away. Because those were two of my favorites. So we kind of had a brief kind of conversation like that then too, because I didn't know. So that's all going through my head. And he's like, and the dad tells me, you know, Homer didn't have an episode. Homer passed away. And it was game over for me, like instantly. There was no being strong. There was nothing. It was just full out tears. And because in our household, in our family, you know, dogs are children for us. They're part of the family. And I remember Dad was strong for me in that moment and was there for me. But it was one of those memories that just, that situation couldn't have been handled more beautifully in my mind. More nurturing. And now, as a father myself, it's one of those examples. It's a prime example, as you're talking about, not naturally being a dad, but it doesn't matter. Talking about answering the vocation of fatherhood, I always had it, maybe it was a vocation for me. It became a vocation for you, and it became a discernment process that I guess you had to go through. Especially loving mom. You don't have a choice. If I'm going to be with this woman the rest of my life, I have A, B, and C to deal with, too. But to this day, I said it to a Catholic, I could love my dad any more than I do now. The relationship we've grown, even before Gabriella came around, it's only gotten better since then, because now we can share like fatherhood stories and stuff. But every moment that we have together is cherished on an awesome level that I can't fully explain. You know, it's just one of those things that I look forward to it. It's why anytime I'm on this side, on your side of town, it's like, hey, you know, I know it's kind of last minute, but I'm over here. Do you need anything? Are you available for coffee or lunch or whatever? You know. And if I have my daughter, it's easier because then it's like, hey, I've got the kid.
Well, but I've demonstrated to you that you don't have to have the kid for me to meet you for lunch. So,
it's just a bargaining chip, just in case there is resistance. Well, I'm busy. I've got Gabriella. Oh, I can cancel that meeting.
But I'd like to add something about your story about Homer. That it's interesting to me that you brought that up. Because I think that as fathers, when we're going through the moment, you know, one of the things that I embrace as a father, and I'd really like to get your opinion on this too, Mark, is that... And as a husband, I discerned very early on that, kind of like what you were talking about earlier, is that there are times when you're feeling the hurt and you're feeling the pain and you have to be strong for everybody else at that moment. Like for me, and this may be a weakness, I don't know, that's why I want to get your input. When there are things like that, when things are tough or whatever, Stacy cannot see me be weak. I got to be strong for her. If I'm going to be weak, I'm going to be weak on my own, or I'm going to be weak with you. Mm. You know, because that's where my iron gets sharpened, because you're my best friend. But what stands out for me is that in that moment, you know, I'm consoling you. I have no idea that fast forward now, however many years it is, your daughter loves your little dog. And there's, you know, the day's going to come when Ribby passes, mm-hmm. and you have something to draw on. And there's no way that I would have known that back then. But I think that's something that fathers pass on to their sons, is that if you, even when you don't realize it, if you can be a role model for them, then it's going to pay off later. But anyway, what's your thoughts on the whole idea of being strong?
Until I married Rosie, there I had no sons. So I had Tiffany, my one daughter, and my her mother had a hysterectomy shortly after Tiffany was born. And so there wasn't another baby. And adopting just didn't hit me at all. So I just was like, okay, well, I've got Tiffany and that's it. But we had a couple of incidents where... like she had a hamster that died, we had a cat that died, and that sort of thing. And I never tried to keep it from her or anything like that. I just straight up told her how it was, and then I just held her, and I just absorbed. I kind of saw myself as just, I just needed to absorb this pain, let her put it out there, and I just absorbed it. It was oddly the only way I could protect her, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But it was my job to just absorb it, let her cry, let her do it. You know, I didn't try to make her stop crying. I didn't do any of that. I read something a really long time ago in a book that was, centered around American Indian. It's a work of fiction, but there was a statement in there that struck me, and it was when something happened to, you know, something bad happened to a person in the tribe, whether it was the chief or the most prominent, you know, hunter or warrior or whatever, that he couldn't go do anything until he cried, because they said, until you cry, you're insane. It wasn't the exact words, but that was essentially the message. something happened and there is a reaction to that, and if you bottle it up, then you're crazy. They could not think straight. And so it was, you've got to let, so what the basis of that was, whether it was real or not, it felt real. And so that's how I approached it with Tiffany when something bad was happening, was that I trusted that sort of our bodily response to pain. I just trusted it, that we're built a certain way. We need to let the process happen. And I just absorbed. And so I don't know if that's being strong for her, or, you know, I don't know, but it was just the accepting of the moment, not trying to make excuses, not trying to make it better. Just, I'm here with you. I'll be here when we're tomorrow. You know, I think in that respect, probably the biggest thing maybe that Tiffany got out of all of that was that she just knew I was there and that was good enough. So,
any final thoughts you'd like to share?
It would be so much better if Gabriella did not love my dog.
Yeah, but that's...
No,
but I think you're ready for it. You know, if honestly, until you shared that story, I mean, I remember it, but I never knew the impact that had on you until you just shared that. So you have that memory to draw upon. You know, if it's, you know, how old is Ruby now? 8?
No, she's going on 9. We got her right before, shortly after we got married. I mean, it was pretty quick.
Yeah, so. You know, maybe you got 5 years, maybe you don't, but, you know, for a lot of children, their first experience with death is a pet, and it's just as impactful to them as losing a loved one, yeah. You know, a person.
So, get her a goldfish.
You should get it out of the way.
In my house, it'd have to be like an elephant or a monkey.
Yeah, she's moved on to the monkey. Really, Angie?
Yeah, she's a... my daughter's got... She's got 3 hand puppets.
Hand puppets.
Well, yeah, she's got 3 hand puppets, but one of them... I don't know, is Pinky a puppet? She's got a little elephant she's had since...
Yeah, that one's not a puppet. The other ones are, because those are the ones I got her.
Well, the original elephant is Pinky. Then she's got 2 hand puppets. The other one of them is an elephant. Its name is Gray. And then the other one's a monkey, whose name is Monkey, because I didn't come up with a name quick enough, and so she just started calling him Monkey. And they have ranks. Pinky was like the colonel, but then Pinky got demoted. And then Gray took over, and now Monkey's moving up in ranks. It's fun. Fatherhood is fun. Because I get to play along with it. Because I go, Pinky and the Gray. Pinky and the Gray.
Oh, wow. Pinky and the Brain.
Yeah, that's right. What are we going to do today? Same thing we do every day. Try and take over the world.
Is that a line from that show?
Yes. So, I don't know if I have some final thoughts. Fatherhood is fun. Fatherhood is a challenge. We do the best we can do. And like I said on Saturday, pray. And when you think you've prayed enough, pray again.
Pray some more. Yeah.
Do you have any final thoughts to add to what you said? Because you've been a father longer than both of us.
Yeah. So, it's easy. No. You know, I'll say this. In many, many ways, I would say I was not a good father because I didn't raise Tiffany in any religion. Tiffany became Catholic after her and Nathan got married. And they both sort of came to it the same way, or essentially at the same time. And it would have to be because I loved Rosie. When Rosie and I got married and we decided to take Leon through RCIA, that just sort of reignited a sensitivity that I'd had from when I was a kid. I went to a Catholic school from kindergarten through 7th grade. And as as we were sitting in RCIA classes with Leon, I just remembered stuff. I mean, because in Catholic school, one of the classes was religion. So I had, you know, kindergarten through seventh grade of religion classes. I could answer questions. I could help explain. I ended up helping teach RCIA for youth for 3 years after that, just because. And that must have made an impact in some kind of way with Tiffany and Nathan, because they just started asking me questions. And so I became, in some ways, a proper father after Tiffany got married, which is sad, I guess. But the role of a dad for a daughter, I know from personal experience from my own family. I'm the oldest of seven kids, and there's four daughters. And one of the things that I figured out, without going into a lot of Jerry Springer kind of revelation, is that the daughter's self-esteem is tied to the father. It's not tied to them. Somebody may want to object to that, or they may want to claim that's a gender.
Yeah, I think whatever. Dr. Mike Beaker would agree with you.
100%. But the simple reality of it is that it's tied to the father. And the one thing that I knew that I was going to do was Tiffany was going to have a healthy sense of self-esteem. And the way that was going to be done was I was going to tell her, you are good, you are beautiful, you are smart, you are important. And it wasn't that I said you're important, but something that I figured out when she was very young, as if I was sitting in the room talking and she came in, I would stop whatever I was doing and focus my whole attention on her, because she came in for a reason, to ask a question or get some attention or whatever. I would give it to her, and then she would leave. If I had said, no, not now, or anything like that, then there would have been the, well, my daddy doesn't think I'm important. It wouldn't have been phrase that way in her brain because she was too young.
Sure.
But that's what the message is. Let's face it, that's the message. You're not important to me right now. I'm doing other stuff here. Every single time she came to me, as far as I can recall, I stopped whatever I was doing and focused my whole attention on her, telling her that she mattered by my actions with her. And I think it makes a huge difference. And she got the same kind of attention from her mom. But like I said, for whatever the reason is, and I can only speak to daughters because that's what I have, their sense of who they are and their self-esteem is totally dependent on the dad. And so as a father, anybody who is becoming a father or something like that, they need to understand that. They need to know they matter. They need to know that they're important to you. And if you do that, you know, now I only had one daughter, I didn't have seven kids, so I don't know if I just got lucky, but there's a whole bunch of crap that Tiffany could have done that she just didn't do, and I think it's because, and if you ask Nathan, her husband, he completely did not understand this whole idea of Tiffany would say, no, I can't do that. Why? Because my dad said no, and he was like, screw your dad. I mean, what do you mean? And she's like, I'm not going to do it. So there was a respect for, even if, I mean, she didn't even have to say, hey, daddy, can I go, you know, whatever. She just knew, and she was fine with it. So, and I think that's because she knew that she mattered to me. So
my final thought would be is, having read Meg Meeker's latest book, and just kind of from my own observation of my fatherhood to my three kids, is that all of which are not my biological children, is that it is never too late to start being the father you're supposed to be. You know, it's interesting to me to not hear Kevin talk about the times I wasn't there. I don't know if he's blocked him out of his memory or whatever. But, you know, I think we all have regrets as fathers. Hopefully you won't have any of these. But, because you're making better decisions early on than I did. And that was that, you know, when you were in middle school and you were starting to do your plays and stuff, I wasn't there for all of them because I was out concentrating on my career. But he was given a second chance in later life. I mean, he talks about the time we spend together now. And so, you know, I've tried to make that a priority, and I've tried to make it a priority with him, and I've tried to make it a priority with spending time with him and his family. Because I feel like God's given me a second chance with that. And Meg Meeker talks about that in her book, is that, you know, you got to be the one that reaches out. You know, maybe it's an adult child that's grown up bitter towards you, but you can always reach out, and there's still a chance for you to rehabilitate that relationship. Because at the core, the children still want the approval of their father.
Yeah.
And you and I know that as adults. I mean, heck, you and I are both in our 50s, and you're not 60.
I am 60.
All right, well, you're 60 now. So, in our 50s and 60s, and there's still a little part of us that seeks the approval of our father. I think that's just something that just never goes away, particularly with sons, you know. Sons want to make sure that their dads approve of what they've done and whatnot. So it's not too late to recapture that.
Yeah.
But it takes work. And you know, I think Kevin talked about some of that. It's something that you have to work on and you have to pray about. And thankfully, we have God the Father as an example. And then on a more temporal level, St. Joseph. And I think that for me, I think one of the reasons why I've had such a great devotion to St. Joseph early on is that initially when I became a father, it was like I'm raising children that are not my biological children, but they're my children. You know, I there's nothing in Scripture that says this, but I don't think that Joseph ever said, this is my foster child.
Right.
He would, you know, I venture to guess he always called Jesus his son.
Yeah.
And treated him as such. And so, anyway. So I think praying for the graces to be a better father is a good thing too, you know. And know that there are good saintly examples in Scripture. And then among our, that's the other reason why we should have good male friends, you know, that.
Yeah.
You know, that you can lean on to talk about stuff like that. Before we close out, I'll say that we will eventually, even if we have to do it as a mini episode, get to the answer of why are the Marian doctrines important. All right, so that's what we look forward to talking about next week. Smoke them if you got them.
All right, good night.